This is March 9th, 2018, and I'm Mark Robbins, and I'm interviewing John Meza for the South Texas Hispanic Farm Labor Community's Oral History Project. And if you wouldn't mind, would you tell me a little bit about your background? Where are you from?
Well, my legal name is Juan Roberto Meza, and I was born in Fremont, Ohio, which is in Sandusky County, which is several thousand miles away.
I'm from Michigan, so I've been
right
through
down
there.
The road.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's where I was. That's where I was born. I was born in Ohio during the latter end of a sugar beet season. So it was snowing at the time when my mom went into labor, and it's one of the latest periods of the year that we ever stayed there in Ohio. We were usually done earlier, but the harvest was there. And I grew up, when I wasn't up there in Ohio working, I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley, South Texas, in San Benito. And it's about 20 miles from the southern border of the United States. Mm-hmm. So basically from border to border.
Yeah.
I grew up for the first 17 years of my life.
And so your parents were working in Ohio before you were born. How long did they do that? What was their background?
My mother and my father were both born in the United States. My father immigrated from Guanajuato, Mexico. He was from the Chichimec Indian peoples there. And a funny thing is that when he crossed the border and submitted his documentation, they actually changed his last name from M-E-S-A to M-E-Z-A. So we've been M-E-Z-A ever since. Because we have, I have an uncle who still uses the M-E-S-A version of our last name.
Wow.
So my father was born in Lubbock. Also during the harvest, they were picking carrots and onions out there at the time. In 1941, my mother was born in 1942 in San Benito, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. Her parents also, my mom's parents, they immigrated from Mexico as well.
Wow, okay. And so when they immigrated, was it for work, do you know, or for it to be with other family members that were already here?
It's always been about work. Mm-hmm. It has always been about work. Everybody that I know that has gone up to Ohio for one reason or another, or to Florida, or to Michigan to pick apples, or Washington to pick apples, or wherever to pick strawberries, it's always been about work. They've always crossed that border, it's in Texas-Mexico border, mm-hmm. for work. And they just ended up making a life here.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever share any stories of what they remember it being like back in those times?
Yes. I sit just like this with my mother whenever I go visit at least once a month. I drive down to San Benito. I'm going there tomorrow.
Oh, great.
I'll tell you another story about why I'm going later. But we sit around the table and have coffee and breakfast, and we talk. And then my sisters come over because they live next door. And then we start talking and more talking. And it's one of the things that I never really appreciated about my culture is that oral history. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm just honored that you even asked me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Believe me.
the stories that I would tell, or that my mother would tell, and my father and my grandfather, were about the border and how different it was back then. And people would come across from Mexico early in the morning, and they would set up camp along the arroyo, along the United States border side, and they would set up kitchens, full-size kitchens, and I mean fire pits as far as you can see. Wow. And all the men would come over from Mexico, and they would work in the fields all day long, and they'd bring the children. And the children would be educated by other teachers and other family members while they were there. They would do their laundry. They would sew. They would repair clothes. Anything was broken, and as they were working, they would patch it up right there and then. So they would all have breakfast, they would all have lunch, and then around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, they'd pack everything up, go back to Mexico, and come back the next day. And my mom says that when she was a little girl, she remembers seeing that along the border every morning, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people just working all in the fields, coming over from Mexico just for the day, getting paid their daily wage, and then going back home. And she could smell just the food that was just cooking over open pits, and caldos and tacos and tortillas and everything just being made over an open fire while the men worked in the fields.
And so did most people preparing the food, or for that matter, the men in the fields, did they know each other from communities in Mexico?
Well, that in and of itself is a community. Mm-hmm. I mean, you end up forming relationships and partnerships with coworkers just mm-hmm. like anybody else. And when you have a responsibility as the only breadwinner in the family, which is predominantly what that was initially, they would be responsible for not just their own kid, but everybody else's kids mm-hmm. as well, you know, because it literally takes a village sometimes to, mm-hmm. to raise kids. And when you live, one of the things that I remember from it was called the labor camp in Ohio, was just that it was a community. And there was at least 30 to 50 families. And some were small, 2 or 3 members, some were as much as 15 in one family. But everybody worked. Mm-hmm. Everybody was in the fields. There was nobody stayed at home to take it easy that day mm-hmm. or to stay behind and cook. Everybody was in the field from sun up to sundown. And you made breakfast early in the morning, you took it with you. You made lunch early in the morning, you took it with you. You didn't come home for lunch, you didn't go to McDonald's, you didn't take a little break. You just worked all day long till the work was done. You came home, you showered, and you hung out with your mm-hmm. friends. And everybody knew everybody. And if I got out of line on the other side of the labor camp, my mom would find out about it because somebody would tell her. Mm-hmm. Because it was just this. There was no way to get away from people who didn't know you. You know, I mean, it was scary sometimes because everybody knew your business. But it was also a little comforting to know that you could go to any single house and ask for water or ask for food, and they would give it to you without question.
What were the houses like?
The houses were all 2-room houses. They were simple plywood, shingle roofs. The big room was at the main entrance, was always for parents, and it was a kitchen, and it was a living room, and it was the entertainment room. The back room was where everybody else slept, and everybody had bunk beds. We had either, there were usually full-size beds where 2 or 3 of us slept in one bed. I grew mm-hmm. up with sleeping next to one of my sisters for the first 9-10 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And they had, other than insulation, they had no running water inside. We had a gas stove, and that gas came from a very large propane tank that not just fed our home, but maybe 15 others. There's at least 2 of those large tanks. We also had community showers. So there was about 4 shower stalls for men, 4 for women. They had 2 separate ones, one on either side of the camp. All of the water was well water. There was no city water. And we had outhouses, which was different because when we came to the Rio Grande Valley, we had an actual house in the city with running water and an air conditioning unit in the window.
So what was that like as a kid going back and forth? Did you have any kind of feelings about it, where you preferred to be, or which sort of what memories did you have?
The memories that I have are, it was an adventure. Mm-hmm. When I was in the Rio Grande Valley, I had friends and we all had houses, but I understood the poverty of the kids who lived out in the colonias where they didn't have running water and they still had outhouses. And I sympathized with them because I knew that for 4, 5, 6 months out of the year, that's what I was going to experience up north. Mm-hmm. But they were experiencing that same situation where I was at as a kid. And when I was going to school, all of my cousins were also going to school, and everybody knew who was a migrant and who wasn't, because they knew that, you know, usually in March every year, the migrant population would just vanish and take off up to Ohio. Mm-hmm. So the school would lose, you know, 100, 150 students every year. But we had to go to school up north. Mm-hmm. So when I was up north going to school, the road, the travel time, you were in a truck. You know how long it takes to get out of the state of Texas? It took us an entire day to go from the mm-hmm. southern tip of Texas to Texarkana, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And in Texarkana, Arkansas, the Arkansas and Texas border, a little town called Hope, where mm-hmm. Bill Clinton was yeah. from, there was a way station, which was a migrant station. And that's where all the migrant families would stop on their way up north. And from there, they had pictures on the wall or carvings or knife carvings or writings on the wall of all these different families that had been through there. And I remember stopping there, and they had this huge, huge shower bathroom section with like 50 showers, 50 urinals, 50 bathrooms, and so forth, right next to a railroad track. And they had little trailers right next to the railroad track. Mm. And we would pay $10 for a little trailer overnight. And the train would come by at least twice that night and rattle the whole thing. Wow. We always talk about that. And we would go across the street, and they had a little pool table, a bumper pool table, air hockey, television, books, coloring books, videos, just a little break from the road. And we'd get on the road and we'd take off again. But once we got out of Texas during that road trip, we started experiencing more and more racism. So we didn't make a lot of stops. We only stopped for gas at the same stops every single year. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that my uncles would tell my dad, and my dad would tell everybody else, it's safe to stop here mm-hmm. at this gas station. So we went to, you know, a certain city in a certain town. We looked for that one little Shell gas station on this highway, and that's where we stopped for gas. And we never stopped anywhere else.
Wow.
And we would stop at, like, a Kentucky Fried Chicken. But my dad would go inside or through the drive-thru, and we'd end up eating outside because we didn't want to deal with the racism and people looking at us and yelling at us, because it happened before. Mm-hmm. We actually got chased down in just north of Arkansas, coming into Missouri. Yeah, it was in Missouri. And I remember they were throwing rocks at our trucks. But fortunately, there was like five of us in a convoy. But there was, you know, a bunch of white guys throwing beer bottles at our trucks because they saw that we were from Texas and with big trucks and campers. And we were kids in the back of the truck, you know, looking out the window. These people just screaming, yelling at us and cussing at us. But growing up, going up north, as you get there, those memories, it was fun. Most of the time, mm-hmm. it was fun. Because, I mean, you're a kid and you're experiencing different things, and you're not alone because your cousins are coming with you and your friends from the Rio Grande Valley mm-hmm. are coming with you, and you see the same people there year after year after year. And the only real problem for me, and I think for most of us, was that we had to go to school. And again, we had to deal with the racism. Because mm-hmm. we would go into school and we'd have to go to the nurse's office, and the nurse would inspect us for lice because obviously all Mexican kids have lice. And they would, whether we had it or not, they would pour this white lye powder on our head. So we had to go the rest of the day with that powder on our head. Wow. So I would deal with that. And then I would deal with all the white kids and black kids making fun of me. So I ended up getting into fights a lot. And, you know, you get into enough fights, eventually, at some point, they stop leaving you. They start leaving you alone when you start winning fights. Mm-hmm. So I got pretty good at it.
And so were the schools then just the regular schools they had up there, or were they?
It's just a regular elementary school, Atkinson Elementary.
Hmm. So you would join then later in the year, and a lot of the other students were there throughout the whole year. And then,
and I knew many of those students because I'd mm-hmm. go to that same elementary school, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way every year. And the same thing would happen every year. But by the time fourth or fifth grade came around, they started leaving me alone. And it was funny because some of the kids that I got along with were these really poor white trash trailer kids who had the same pair of clothes day after day after day. And they were the ones that saw, you know, the same kind of suffering mm-hmm. because they were singled out because of the way they live. And they're poor. I had the same pair of jeans. I had like three pair of jeans. That's it.
Did you feel like you experienced a lot of racism from the teachers or administration as well? Or were they different?
No, the teachers weren't. I never experienced any racism from the teachers. A lot of it had to do with You know, just I like learning. Mm-hmm. I was never a dumb kid. You know, I mean, I like reading. I like understanding things. I was very active. I was probably more physically active than most of those kids because whenever I wasn't at school, I was working somewhere with my dad or my mom growing up. Everybody grew up in the field. You learned how to pick pickles and tomatoes as long as you were old enough to walk.
So do you remember a time when you were a kid when you weren't in the fields, or was it just as far back as you remember? You were there too and along with the rest of the family?
I was there. I was, like I said, I was born in Ohio in November the 4th, 1966. And from that day forward, my parents had been going up there for the previous 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And we kept going every single year. And my earliest memories of Ohio are me walking early in the morning in these rubber boots because it's, you know, morning dew. And I can barely fit in them, but I've got a hamper, and I'm pulling two hampers next to me. It's like a bushel, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm plucking pickles with these huge Rubbermaid plastic gloves and putting them into the baskets, just like the adults, because that's what you do. You see the adults do that, and that's what you do. I mean, it's not rocket science. You know, you grow up doing what everybody else does, and you get used to it. And after a while, that's all that you know how to do. And you sort of get into the cycle of going over and over and over again. You don't feel that there's any options. And that's what happens to a lot of my aunts and uncles, is that they kept going back because they didn't have any other options. So they came back down to the Rio Grande Valley. They were either working in the fields or they were working for some sort of produce farm as other ranch hands or as drivers, truck drivers, which is what my father did when we were in the valley. That's how he earned a living. He was a truck driver for a Palm Valley Fruit Company. So.
And so he would he go around neighborhoods, pick people up, take them there?
No, he was an actual truck driver. So the Palm Valley Fruit Company was they were like a distributor of oranges and grapefruits and other vegetables. So my father would drive into the fields every day, and they'd load him up with tomatoes, cucumbers, whatever, and he'd bring them back to the company.
Okay.
And he'd dump them off, and he'd go back for another load, come back, dump them off, come back. And he did that for the entire, it was oranges and grapefruits in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Fall and winter, that's when the harvest is, right before the freezes. And then after that, he'd work in harvesting as a truck driver for some of the other ranches with the bell peppers and okra and different things like that. But he worked for that palm fruit vegetable company. Hmm.
Did he ever share any impressions of what it was like to work for the company, how they treated the workers, any impressions of that? And also in Ohio, when working in the fields, did you all come across the growers at all? Or mostly foremen, and
no,
what was
no,
that
the,
like?
The actual, when we were in Ohio, the actual owners, the owners of the property, the ranch owners, they were very nice people, mm-hmm. very nice people. Treated us well, gave us as much as we could. We saw some of the other labor camps up there, and they weren't mm-hmm. anywhere near as nice as ours. They had an annual party for us every year, you know, barbecue and everything on them. Very, very nice people. A lot of the things that I learned from my father were never verbal or oral. He was not the big speaker type. He was the more action type. What I learned from my dad was his work ethic. By the time I was 15 years old, I was working with my father and my older uncles and my dad's friends as a truck driver, tractor driver, 15, 18 hours a day. And for me, that was fun mm-hmm. because my father sort of gave me that status, and they all gave me that respect. So by the time I was 15, I was considered a man by my mom and by my sisters, by my uncles. That's the way they saw me, pulling my weight, earning my keep. I was getting more money because what we got was pooled into this family mm-hmm. account. Yeah, Dad would give us some money now and then, but once I made 15, and once I started earning more and more hours, she started giving me more and more money. I didn't know what to do with it. I was 15. I wasn't used to it. But
did you work 5 days a week, 7 days a week?
7 days a week over the summertime. It never ends.
Was there any time for recreation at all, or just
We recreated a lot because everybody sees the work. Mm-hmm. You know that you're out in the sun all day long, bent over, mm-hmm. from early dawn to just before dusk, and there's a sort of a quota that we mm-hmm. set up ourselves up for. So let's say, for as far as tomatoes go, we used to pick those by hand. So you can pick tomatoes only so many times before they're just gone from the vine. They don't grow anymore. Whereas pickles grow, they have a cycle. They keep growing as long as they're getting pollinated. When we're picking pickles, let's say we had X amount of acres, and they'd be divided in rows. So we would say we're going to harvest or pick 150, 200 rows a day mm-hmm. over 3 days. So by the time you're done with that third section, you come back to the first one, and the pickles are grown again. That's how fast they grow.
Wow.
So that was the cycle. So we would pick for 3 days, and then we start all over again. We'd pick for 3 days, and start all over again. And we would put up these little, everybody had these little hampers. The hampers are baskets, that's what we call them. They're just a little basket where you put all these pickles in. And you would stack them at the mark. And that's visually where we need to mm-hmm. go get to by the end of today. And you just go and you go and you go and you go until you get there. And once you get there, you go home. And if you have friends and say, hey, we have this and let's do this and let's go here. So I got to finish. Well, mm-hmm. next thing you know, we have like 15 extra hands helping us just so that we can finish work that day. That's how families are.
Yeah.
You know, and the tomatoes were a little bit different because those were initially picked by hand and you could still smell the pesticides on them early in the mornings, especially with the morning dew. But they would spray them with pesticides, not just to kill weed, but eventually to dry up the plants because they're just so heavy with tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And we would drag these baskets by hand, bent over. Sometimes you put them on a belt and they mm-hmm. would hang from your hip. So you had to be, your legs were pretty strong, your back had to be really strong. Mm-hmm. And then the men, at the end of the day, after picking all of that, you had somebody who actually had to take those baskets of tomatoes and pull them inside a trailer by hand. So you're picking up these 40, mm-hmm. 50-pound baskets, throwing them up to somebody else who's hanging on the edge of a little walkway of a trailer, dumping them by hand. And then from there, that gets taken to like the Heinz plant where they manufacture mm-hmm. ketchup and mm-hmm. pickles in jars and stuff like that. So to have that kind of work required a lot of strength and stamina. So when I was 15, 16, 17, that's what I was doing. And I was doing this with men who were anywhere from 5 to 20 years older than I was. And it was a pretty big deal at mm-hmm. the time.
Did you ever encounter folks that developed health problems or, you know, throughout their backs and things like that? And how did communities out in the fields and in the camp pitch in? How did you all contend with that?
We had our own little curanderos. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew the local, you know, doctor. Mm-hmm. And they would come and we would pick weeds out and from the woods, and my grandfather would plant weeds and herbs just for those purposes. And they had this remedy where they would grow pot mm-hmm. and they would take the pot leaves and put them in alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that's what they would use to rub on sore joints and muscles. I don't know if it worked. I just mm-hmm. know that everybody did that. Mm-hmm. There were different remedies, but it was rare that we had somebody actually going to the hospital because of an injury. Nobody had mm-hmm. health insurance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they wouldn't see us if we went into a hospital. Mm-hmm. So we tended to fix ourselves, cure ourselves, or just deal with the injury until we got back to the Rio Grande Valley where there was more help. They mm-hmm. had clinics and so forth that they could go to. They didn't have that up in Ohio for us. Mm-hmm.
And so most of the curanderos or curanderas, they were also working in the fields,
yes.
migrating.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, you mentioned, was your grandfather or your father, I'm sorry, that
knew
about the different herbs?
My grandfather was just an amazing man. He was my mom's dad. And he was a little bitty guy. He was like 4'9", 4'10". And one of the greatest lessons that I learned from him was about the land, about just living off the land, about living simply. And when my father passed away, that's why I wore t-shirts and blue jeans mm-hmm. to honor my father. Mm-hmm. Because he was a very simple man, very simple. And that's what he wore at the end mm-hmm. of his life, just t-shirts, blue jeans. He didn't need anything else.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather, I remember going deer hunting. I was like 8, 9 years old. And this is in the Rio Grande Valley, Zapata County, out by Falfurrias. And rather than take me actually hunting with a rifle, he goes, "You just come with me." So we made breakfast for everybody, and I'd go with him, and we would walk. And what he had done throughout the year was plant herbs mm-hmm. and spices throughout the mm-hmm. our hunting area. And there was this old abandoned church that he would go to. And I remember he would go and he would kneel down and he would say, I don't know what he was saying, but mm-hmm. he'd get back up and, "What are you doing, Grandpa?" I said, "I'm praying for my enemies, that they die, all of them." And he goes, "And also I pray for you that you learn how to live off the land." And he would tell me about, we would pick wild garlic that he had planted. Mm-hmm. We would pick tomatoes that he had planted. We would pick cucumbers, calabaza, the actual cucumber. So it's like a zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
But the flower of the zucchini, the yellow flower, is called flor de calabaza. He would take that and we'd put that in tacos. Wild chile de monte, which is chile piquin. The maguey plant, which is what they make tequila from.
Mm-hmm.
It grew wild out there. We would dig it up, and they had these big, thick, white grub worms. And we'd mm-hmm. take those also to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And he would make these cages for quail. And they had this entrance. It's a cone like this. It's wide, then it narrows. So the quail go in, but they can't come back out. So after, 30 or 40 of them were bundled in there, they got nowhere to go. We'd reach in, and we'd just rip off their heads mm-hmm. and watch them run around till they die. And then we'd go back to deer camp. And for lunch, we'd make quail breast meat
mm-hmm.
on a pan with homemade corn tortillas that we would make by hand. He showed me how to do that. And we would chop up the wild tomatoes, the garlic, the flor de calabaza, the chile, the grub worms, and make tacos out of them. And he would always tell me, "There's nothing that this world cannot provide for you, mm-hmm. nothing."
Do you know where he learned all of these exceptional things?
He just learned it himself. He made these things. He would take deer skin and make pouches. He would have everybody pee in a bucket and take the deer skin, take all the hair off of it, and drop that deer skin inside urine, because that's how they used uh-huh. to tan hides long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have everybody literally piss in a bucket and soak the deer skin in there for a couple of days. Then he'd take it out, stretch it, get it nice and soft, and then he'd take the maguey plant, if you up here where the needle is, if you start pinning it real slowly, you can actually pull off a thread. And he would take those and hang them on the line and use that to sew up deer skin. He would braid it and make a nice thick heavy cord, and he would sew deer skin pouches together. He would take the teeth from wild boars and deer that would make necklaces out of them. He would pick wild herbs and plants and put them in his little bags and take them home, and people would come by for those herbs and plants. Men, women, other people who were like home healers. He would grow them out there, because not everybody would grow them at their mm-hmm. homes. But the land was just so fertile out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I never asked where he learned them. It was just so cool to watch all of that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that really sounds impressive, amazingly resourceful. Did you ever get a chance to then work in the fields with him? Was he still out
there? My grandfather?
There?
Yes, mm-hmm. briefly. They stopped coming up probably the last three or four years that I stopped. Because I stopped when I was 17, 18, turned 18. Because what I saw was every generation just kept going. Mm-hmm. All of my friends just kept going, and I did not want to do that anymore. I knew that there was something else out there for me. I did not want to work in the fields, get a family, a wife, and the kids, and travel all over the United States as a migrant worker. Mm-hmm. There was no way I was going to do that. And it hurt my father because I was the only boy. I'm the only male in the family. I got two older sisters and two younger sisters. And in many cases, it is the responsibility of, you know, you carry on the family tradition type of thing, mm-hmm. you know. And I said, no, I'm going to join the military. And I didn't join the military because, you know, I was a flag-waving patriot. I joined mm-hmm. the military because I didn't want to pick pickles and tomatoes mm-hmm. the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But right after that, he got really sick with diabetes, and we just stopped going. He couldn't make it anymore. So he ended up trying to make it down the Rio Grande Valley. But yeah, I worked with my grandfather for a few years in the fields. I mostly worked with my other uncles, his sons, my mom's brothers. And I grew up with them in the fields, working, mm-hmm. going hunting, doing all sorts of things.
So did you ever do anything other than, of course, the work itself to pass the time when you were picking cucumbers and tomatoes or anything else out there?
There was lots of forests out there because there was lots of land, and it was very sparsely populated, mm-hmm. house here and there. So we would walk for miles. We would follow a creek just for miles, just to be walking along a creek and look for tadpoles and frogs and mm-hmm. turtles and whatnot. And we would make slingshots out of branches mm-hmm. and old tire tubes, because my grandpa taught me how to make a slingshot out of branches and tire tubes mm-hmm. and old the tongue from an old boot. We would go to the drive-in a lot. That was a big thing in Ohio. And it was like $5 a carload. So, and everybody had a truck. So every Saturday night, mm-hmm. two or three trucks would load up. They just park at the front of the labor camp. And everybody would say, hey, we're leaving at 6:30, 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Bring your quarters. Everybody would pitch in a quarter for the five mm-hmm. bucks, load up truckloads. Everybody had, you know, a nice chest full of sodas and popcorn and sandwiches. And we'd go to the movies. That was the thing to do in the summertime. Mm. And then there were auctions. My dad was big on auctions because they were out in the rural areas, mostly a lot of farmers. And a lot of those mm-hmm. farmers were familiar with, you know, all the migrants coming up. So he felt pretty safe over there. And he knew mm-hmm. a lot of them because he was a foreman mm-hmm. at the labor camp where I was at. And he was big on guns. He was always finding some old guns. Even if they didn't work, he wanted an old gun for like $30, you know. There was also a Mexican cinema, and I think it was in Findlay, and it was the only one in mm-hmm. the entire area. And that was a big thing because a lot of the people there were Spanish speaking only. So we would go to an actual cinema that we could feel comfortable mm-hmm. in because everybody in there spoke Spanish. So, we didn't go into the city a lot, like going to the malls and stuff like uh-huh. that, just because of, you know, the racism, the sneers, and it was usually my mom and dad who would do those types of things. I think there was like these two stores, these shopping centers where we would go, where everybody would go. So it mm-hmm. was, you know, you felt comfortable there because, like, I remember, like I told you about the gas stations on the way up there. It's mm-hmm. the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. there was a store called the Big Wheel, and it's like a smaller version of a Walmart, basically, where it has a little bit of everything. And that's where everybody would go. Everybody goes to the Big Wheel. Everybody goes to Moody's. The A&P Mart mm-hmm. up in Ohio. It's like an HEB.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the other day that there would be these incidents where agents would come around and...
La Migra.
Yeah. I was wondering if you might be willing to share some of the memories you have of that.
We had a, and it wasn't that often, but I remember in the 70s when, I remember my dad coming up one day, we're not buying grapes anymore. We're not going to buy lettuce either. Mm-hmm. He was like supporting Cesar Chavez, mm-hmm. like on the other side of the United States. And we're like, well, we love grapes. We're going to have lettuce for sandwiches. Okay, lettuce is okay, but no more grapes. Nobody's mm-hmm. buying grapes. Okay, I didn't understand it. But in the end, I figured, you know, that's why he was like solidarity with Cesar Chavez, the farm mm-hmm. workers, boycotting, you know. And they had, every now and then we would have Border Patrol agents go to, they would never stop at the labor camp initially. They would always stop at the actual landowners, ranchers' houses and ask about, you know, the people. And I don't remember any of the actual discussions. I just remember them going and everybody's like, Lamita's here. And they'll go call Raul and go call Hector and tell them to take off and go hide. And they would take off and they'd run. They'd hide inside the cornfields.
Hmm. How long would they stay there for?
They were just there to ask questions to see if they, because it was sort of, I mean, we're up in Ohio. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not along the Mexico border, but it's a U.S. Border Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
They would just like linger around for a couple hours. But every now and then they would just show up unannounced and they'd stop in the actual fields where we were working and just drive really slow and they'd wait for somebody to start running. And then they'd take off chasing them. But I don't remember them ever catching anybody, to be honest with you, because everybody knew. The thing was is that our the ranchers would plant the either the cucumbers that we harvested or the tomatoes where we harvested, they would always plant corn all the way around for that purpose.
Wow.
So that we had a place to take off and hide. Or if needed, we'd go to the bathroom inside the first couple of rows. They would always do that. And after a while, they started putting it on the front where the actual roads are so that nobody would see us.
Hmm. Did they ever admit that that's what they were doing, or it's just sort of understood?
My dad would tell me because we had we would have drive-bys. My dad was a foreman, so we had the labor camp was this L-shaped, and behind the L was this big spotty woods, and then we had the two big community showers and outhouses throughout. And right here at the front was where we were, and we always lived there, and we always hated that house because we would always be the ones subjected to the drive-bys.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have people just drive by. They shot our truck two or three times. They shot at the house a couple of times. Missed my sister's head by an inch, you know. And it was.
And these were just kind of local,
just local racist yokel, people. Racist people screaming, yelling, cussing at us, shooting at us. And it would happen, you know, every other year.
Did the authorities ever intervene there, or ever get called, or
we? Call them, file a report, but
yeah,
that's all we could do.
Wow. Do you recall in any of the early memories of people coming across the border down in the valley for the day and then going back, was there a lot of harassment from Border Patrol there, or is it just kind of accepted in the
Every now and then you'd have the Border Patrol just drive by the field and just start chasing people down. But that was rare. It was just so different. I remember actually swimming in the Rio Grande by my brother-in-law's house as a kid.
Don described examples of how people would cross through the river.
People were just crossing left and right all the time. And this was before they had all the big levees along the border. And this was definitely before we had the wall. But after a while, I think back in the late 70s and 80s, they started building levees where they could actually patrol the actual border with trucks all the way from Fort Brown, started moving up. But it's nothing like it is now. It was absolutely nothing like it was now.
Do you feel like that's impacted a lot of communities that had more of a fluid relationship between the border back then on both sides? Have you noticed a lot of changes in terms of the tension in those social relationships since when you were a kid?
A lot of those families are gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're my age or older now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm 51. I'll be 52 this year. So the families then are, you know, a lot of them have moved on. They no longer live along that place. I mean, if you ever drive down old Highway 281, you'll see how there's not a lot of life there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are just clinging to that property just because they're glad, you know, eminent domain didn't kick them out of it, but they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
As far as relationship with the border, it's definitely changed. Everybody's perception of it has changed because it's not, what do you call it? I'm at a loss for words. There was a time where Mexico was not seen as an adversary. Mm-hmm. That was not in the dialogue at the time. Now, part of that came about because of the carteles and the violence. You know, I mean, the late 90s, early 2000s, when that really took off. But prior to that, it was just a very simple, I'm going across to go mm-hmm. eat and drink and be merry. And they're coming back with me to eat, drink, and be merry, visit friends. They're going back across the border again. Mm-hmm. The relationship was very symbiotic, is very mutual. Now it's very antagonistic, and that wall creates that. Mm-hmm. I think it makes it even worse. So everybody's perspective of the wall and their relationship with Mexico has changed. Even people who, you know, still live along mm-hmm. the border, especially them.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned after working in the fields until 18, you joined the military. Mm-hmm. How long were you in the military for?
I did 5 years active duty and 5 years in the reserve. Right after I got out, I ended up getting married right away and moved to San Marcos. I did that for 17 years in San Marcos, Texas. And then I was incarcerated for 6 years. And everything changed for me during that mm-hmm. time. Because when I got out, I had $184 in my pocket and 7 trash bags full of personal belongings. Mm-hmm. That's it. And it reminded me right away of being poor again and not having anything. And the only thing I did have was my family. Mm-hmm. So it all sort of came full circle, because when I was younger, I just wanted to get away. I just wanted to leave. Mm-hmm. I moved out of my home when I was 14 years old, and mm-hmm. I started living on my own, not really realizing and appreciating the family that I had. Mm-hmm. I never really made a lot of personal contacts and relationships, build those relationships with my sisters, until I lost everything and I started over. That's when I started, that's why I sit with my mom and have breakfast and coffee mm-hmm. and we talk and we tell stories about mm-hmm. back in the day. That's why I sit with my sisters and my nieces and my nephew at a table and I talk and I ask them and I tell them, how was your day? What are you doing? Oh, you know what? Your mom did this when she was a little mm-hmm. girl, just like you. And, oh yeah, let me tell you about the story about your grandma, what happened when she was a little girl, when I was a kid. And we tell those stories because I think it's important to have that oral mm-hmm. history told to each other. And I remember how my father, when I was growing up, how he would help immigrants as they were crossing, as they were trying to find their way.
John expanded on this theme by adding a powerful example.
And I always remember that moment whenever I feed the homeless. Mm-hmm. And it's, I said earlier that I remember the thing that I learned from my father was my work ethic. Well, I also learned my compassion. So, but that's why I do what I do. If wow. there's an opportunity to help, I know that I can. It doesn't take much. It really does not take much to help somebody out. And if I have the skill set to do that and I have friends that are willing to help me, if there's a need to be met, I want to try to meet it, especially when it comes to somebody who's suffering and hungry. Mm-hmm. So,
and so from the immigrants at that time, I don't know if you would know or not, were they coming to be with family members, to work, all of the above, fleeing anything that was
most of them
difficult?
Most of them had friends. At the time, it wasn't as much, you know, fleeing persecution or fleeing, you know, the cartels or anything. Most of them had at least one or two family members mm-hmm. who were already working somewhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they were receiving money so that they could pay somebody to smuggle them across so that they too could go mm-hmm. live and start working. Mm-hmm. Because the pay scale is completely different. Mm-hmm. So there's a way to make money. That's what they want to do. So they were coming to visit family and stay with them who had already been sending them money, you know what I mean, to cross mm-hmm. and to be here. And then they got employment and then they started working. And the thing is that once they start working, they are going to earn a living. Mm-hmm. The whole family is going to earn a living somehow, some way. They're going to make it. They live off very mm-hmm. little. I remember growing up, we didn't have a huge refrigerator full of food. Mm-hmm. We never did, because we were always saving money to go back to the Rio Grande Valley when we were going to need it, because only mm-hmm. my father was working. So whatever monies we earned, we stocked away in a bank account.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have beans, tortillas, papas, chile, the basics, ground beef. Every now and then we'd have a barbecue. And the big feasts were reserved for like a quinceañera, which was rare up in Ohio, or birthday parties, or some special event. And those special events got crazy because it was, you know, we'd slaughter a pig and a couple of goats, dig a hole in the ground, old school,
mm-hmm.
and the whole, everybody would come. We'd be feeding, you know, 120 mm-hmm. people. But wow. that's why they would come. I mean, a majority of them would come because they already had a family member established in the United States who had been sending them money to come.
Mm-hmm.
And they already usually had a job. And a lot of those field work is easy. It was easy to say, hey, I know somebody. They're a good hand. And it's all that they want. They just want mm-hmm. a good hand who's going to work hard and harvest.
Did you ever, while you were living in South Texas, pick cotton? Or just
no.
fruits and vegetables?
No, just fruits and vegetables. The cotton thing, that was rare. I mean, my mom did it, you know, aunts and uncles did it, but after a while they just got gins, mm-hmm. you know, machines to mm-hmm. do all that for you. And eventually even the tomatoes weren't picked by hand either. They mm-hmm. created machines to do that also.
Do you remember any friends, family members reacting to that? Was this a frustrating thing to see the work going away, or different feelings about it?
No, because there was still plenty of work other available. Work.
Okay.
You know what? We're going to use the machine to pick the cotton, but we're going to start planning something else.
Okay. Hmm. Wow. Have you ever had a chance since then to go back to the Sandusky area to see if any of it's still around, what it's like?
I'd be in tears, probably. I would. The whole time. So at some point before I die,
mm-hmm.
I want to go back. My one of my older sisters, she's the one who actually kept going back. She actually got married up there, and she actually had two kids up there, so she remembers more of that, you know, mm-hmm. towards the later years. She lives in Waco now, but she was into the whole harvest thing with the family for an additional 10 years, I think, into the early 90s. Same thing with one of my other older sister. Her husband, her kids, they kept going probably into the early 90s also,
mm-hmm.
up in Florida. And they stopped. And eventually, everybody stopped.
Mm-hmm. Were there any places that people tended to prefer over other places where the work was better or the challenges lesser? Or any other factors that you can recall?
Florida was a lot. Big. I had a lot of friends and family that went to Florida for strawberries and different things, like oranges also. Once they started having year-round harvesting in the Rio Grande Valley, then nobody mm-hmm. had to leave anymore.
Hmm.
They just work in the fields in the Rio Grande Valley. Because they had just fields and fields of, mm-hmm. you know, cabbage and okra and bell peppers and jalapenos and cucumbers and watermelons, the oranges and the grapefruits. Everything was there. And then they had these bigger farms that took over all these smaller farms. So they ended up planting more and more, giving themselves a variety,
mm-hmm.
or a little bit more diversity as far as what they had to offer as a farm. So then they had harvesting year-round, so a lot of the people stopped going to Florida, stopped going to Ohio, mm-hmm. stopped picking apples up in, you know, in Michigan and Washington State, because it was pretty cold up
there. Yeah.
So.
Did you see a lot of workers coming down to the valley then, working side-by-side with people that live there? Or was it mostly just folks living there doing the local work?
Yeah, it was mostly folks that lived there, because if... whenever we weren't working up in Ohio, we tried to make a life in the Rio Grande Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So to make a life as a migrant field worker in the Rio Grande Valley, mm-hmm. that's not something that everybody, especially my friends, mm-hmm. we had in mind. We went up north to do that. Mm-hmm. When we were in the Rio Grande Valley, it was completely different. We didn't have to work. We had side jobs here and there. Mm-hmm. We went to school with our friends. So to come back, because some of my friends tried it and they didn't like it. They ended up, because there's, I don't know, there's something about those two lives being mm-hmm. separate, you know. And when they went back to the Rio Grande Valley, I remember talking to my cousin. He said, no, I'm not. They wanted to work in the fields, and they all stopped. They said, no, Dad, we're not going anymore. And they all took off to, you know, community colleges to get mm-hmm. degrees. And next thing you know, they're working at some chemical plant, or they're working at some office job, or they're working mm-hmm. fixing cars, because everybody stopped. They didn't mm-hmm. want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get started with Tacos Not Bombs?
When I moved here to Corpus Christi, I went to Unitarian Universalist Church, mm-hmm. and somebody there was volunteering at Timmons Ministries in Flower Bluff, and they were cooking a meal for the homeless population. And I said, I'd like to volunteer. He said, okay. So once a month, we would go, and we would actually prepare the food in the kitchen, and we would serve it there, 60, 70 people, one Saturday a month. And then funding started going away, and they weren't sure if they were going to keep it open, and then somebody got into a fight and broke a window, so they stopped mm-hmm. completely. And there was, I know my purpose in life, and that's to serve. And it's important to me to continue that, because it's something that my father instilled in me when I was a kid. And that story I told you, it's in the forefront of my mind every time I see suffering, every time I see somebody needing something, whether it's food or clothes, shelter, whatever it is. I always mm-hmm. remember that. And I just had to find somewhere to go. So I asked around, and a friend told me, hey, my friends make tacos, and they serve them downtown at a park. Mm-hmm. So I went over there one Sunday, and they were serving lasagna. They were serving mm-hmm. lasagna and Caesar salad and French bread and tea. Mm-hmm. I go, this is more than tacos. And they had like 30, 40 meals, and it was just like 8-10 people mm-hmm. there. I said, I'd like to help. Said, okay, next Sunday, and next Sunday, and next Sunday, and next Sunday, and next Sunday. We just kept coming. Well, our number started growing, and we were only 8-10 people. It was getting expensive mm-hmm. to make more and more food. And it's not that easy for one or two people to make enough food for 70 strangers every single Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's pricey, and it's you know, takes some time. So I suggested I start making Facebook posts about it, and you know, mm-hmm. putting our name out there and getting volunteers and donations. So I've been doing that ever since, and we started growing. The more people came, the more volunteers came, mm-hmm. the more food was available, and we have not. I've been there 3.5 years. We have not missed a single Sunday, even during this last hurricane.
Wow,
we had no electricity, but my phone started to work. And I called 4 or 5 people, and they said, I can get peanut butter, I can get jelly, I can get sandwich bags. The Dollar Tree just opened. They got electricity mm-hmm. again. I called my friend Pastor Cliff. He gave me some money. We bought bottles of water, peanut butter, jelly, bread, sandwich bags. We made 225 sandwich bags with peanut butter and jelly, crackers, and water in it. Wow. And we went to the park. We served up like 45 meals, 45 sandwich bags. And we went down to City Hall. We served some more over there. Went mm-hmm. down to Bluff Park, served some more over there. Then we went to the Good Samaritan. We gave them the rest away.
Do you usually, I know that was during hurricane times, mm-hmm. but do you usually just do Artesian Park or move yes. around a bit?
We've always done Artesian Park since I've been there. Mm-hmm. And when we started to have a lot of volunteers and a lot of donations, somebody suggested that we should find a second site. Mm-hmm. So I got in contact with Metro Ministries, and over at their kitchen at Loaves and Fishes, we now serve a meal one Saturday a month. Mm-hmm. And it's all volunteers, all donations. Last year alone, with Loaves and Fishes, meals one month, one Saturday a month, and then 52 meals at Artesian Park. Mm-hmm. In addition to our meals, we usually serve sandwich bags with either peanut butter and jelly sandwich, ham and cheese, crackers, bottle of water. So that's another meal. So all total, we served over 15,000 meals last year.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is. That's a lot.
That really is.
For just a ragtag bunch of people with, you know, a heart of giving, because that's all it really is. Everybody just wants to donate and give mm-hmm. and give and give. And whenever we ask for food, they show up every Sunday.
Wow.
So, and the reasons I do it are might be different than somebody else's. But in the end, we all have one goal, and that's to serve humanity for whatever reason it is, from whatever role of life you have to play in this world. Everybody shows up every Sunday, 20 to 35 volunteers. It's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's is it something that you've seen then grow over time?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Since correct me if I'm wrong, did it start in 2009, 2010, somewhere around then?
I understand it's been going on for almost 10 years now.
Wow.
And it all started with a couple of guys and a girl handing out tacos in front of City Hall. And eventually all these homeless people started showing mm-hmm. up, and City Hall's like, hey, you know, Sheriff Department's right next to us. You guys need to find a park or somewhere else to go.
Yeah.
So they did. They found a park. And then after a while, they kicked them out of that park because they left a mess, and they sent them somewhere else. And then they sent them somewhere else and ended up at Artesian Park.
And has there been any trouble with authorities or officials yes. about Artesian Park, using Artesian Park? Or?
It's more the local community, the bars and the businesses
okay.
around the park, not wanting that homeless population there every single Sunday, that have made complaints to the city. And they even tried to move us out of the park somewhere else mm-hmm. and saying that we needed a permit. So we went straight to the Parks and Rec people, not the city, mm-hmm. the Parks and Rec,
yeah.
because the city does not run the parks. The Parks mm-hmm. and Rec does. So we went straight to the Parks and Rec department. And we had a meet and greet with them. My friend Isabella Araiza.
Yeah,
Dr. Sandy Watts. I mean, Judge Sandra Watts, federal district judge. They went and spoke with them, and they said, you know what? You guys don't meet the need, the requirements for a permit, because it's essentially a picnic.
Uh-huh.
We're just a bunch of people to get together every Sunday and give away food. Just like you would have uh-huh. a picnic with your friends at a park, mm-hmm. 20, 30, 50, 100. You barbecue, you bring food from home, you eat it, and you go mm-hmm. home. You don't need a permit for that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're doing.
Wow.
So the lady, Laura Hassel, who actually signs the permits for people wanting a permit for an event at a park, she came out and she volunteered and she donated. She made a turkey for us for Christmas.
That's great.
And she was like, you guys, you're in and out in an hour and a half.
Yeah. So. And one thing that strikes me, as you're mentioning these things, is a couple of times when I've struck up conversations with folks living at the park, a lot of them have probably been there a lot longer than some of the business owners nearby mm-hmm. that seem to be complaining about it. So there's that as well. So now it's has the blessing of the Parks Department. That's very good to hear. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time, but are there any other recollections or stories that you'd like to share, things that were particularly memorable experiences, either from your own memories or those that have been passed along from parents, grandparents, or any other relatives or friends?
Everybody that I can remember going up to Ohio with as a migrant are all successful. Because of their work ethic, working in the field, they know what it's like to work, and they're not afraid to work. They know what it's like to work within a team, in a family. Mm-hmm. They know what it's like to sacrifice. They know what it's like to give to others. They know what suffering is. And every time I see them, it's on my Facebook page, and a lot of them are still my friends. Mm-hmm. I see them all as successful people. That's a beautiful thing to know that. They're just so resilient. That's one of the greatest things that gave us, all of us, is the ability to be, you know, the resilience that we have and to deal with change, because it's just constantly back and forth, back and forth. Mm-hmm. That's a big transition. to go from, you know, a nice house with toilets and friends and family inside the city and hustle and bustle to being out in the middle of the sticks dealing with mm-hmm. racism and outhouses and no running water and working out mm-hmm. in the fields all day long. It's, you know what I mean? The, those yeah. two lives are just so different. And to go from that back and forth your entire life as a kid, your teens especially, it was an amazing time. And a lot of the memories, the fond memories that I have are that journey going through the state of Texas and stopping in Hope, Arkansas, and going passing St. Louis, Missouri, and watching that big old arch, you know, and a lot of the adventures that we went through and things that happened on our way up there, they weren't all scary. Some of them were, but they weren't all scary. And I remember spending time with my sisters in the back of a truck for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, if you can deal with your sisters in the back of a truck for 10 hours, you know, you've bonded. You bonded.
Did you guys mostly have conversations back there or play any games or just?
We just listened to music.
Listen, okay.
We listened to a lot of music. Everybody had headphones or little Walkman mm-hmm. radios. So, 8-tracks.
Yeah.
8-tracks were big.
Well, that's even a little bit before my time. Not too much, but a little bit.
I had the Van Halen 8-track when it first came out.
Yeah. I had that on tape.
but I had an 8-track in my car.
Yeah.
There you go.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That, 1984, that must have been... my first, I think that was the first album I got. It was given to me by my brother. It was a cassette tape though, so I can't claim the 8-track, but, wow. Well, those are some great stories. Well, anything else that you'd like to mention before I conclude the recording?
Just that it made me who I am. I mean, all those experiences made me who I am, and for better or for worse, I just try to make the best out of it. And my mother has journals, but they're dream journals, and she's mm-hmm. only been keeping them for the last 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm a writer. A lot of mm-hmm. what I write, not a lot, but everything that I am, everything that I've experienced works his way into my poems. I'm a poet.
I did mean to ask you about that. I'm glad that you brought that up.
I write poetry and I perform poetry. And a lot of what I write about are those memories, and they work their way into my poems. And sometimes I have a poem about my grandfather and the way he smelled. I said, sometimes he smells like tequila. Other times he smells like the nopal after a rain.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember the way my grandpa smelled. I write about immigrants. I write about migrants. I write about the journey from Mexico into the United States. I write about the wall and so forth. And it works its way in there. And I perform these pieces as well. I've actually been asked to be a keynote speaker for the AMAS Awards here at A&M University on the 24th, 25th, something like that, 26th, towards the end of the month.
Okay.
It's a speaking engagement. They want me to read to these young writers who are going to be getting awarded for something. I'm not exactly sure.
That's great.
So, but yeah, all of this works its way into everything that I do in one way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the simplicity of how I live my life. I don't have cable. I haven't had cable in years. Just because I remember growing up in Ohio, we didn't have cable. We barely had a TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember how my father dressed and how simple it was. So I don't have a big wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
Blue jeans and t-shirts, sandals are good for me. I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat a lot either. The stories that I tell are about my life.
Mm-hmm.
The things that I do as an activist are because of the way I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-racism. Anti-poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I'll conclude it there. Thank you again for speaking with me today and allowing us to record your memories. It's really quite an honor. So thank you again. I'll go ahead and
thank you.
Turn these off. Make sure I get the places, right? Oh.